Hi there, this is the producer of the Bat Segundo Show. I'm afraid that Mr. Segundo couldn't in fact make it this week. You see, he was arrested for littering. One of those terrible, ignoble offenses that our finest is actually going ahead and cracking down upon here in San Francisco. So, Mr. Segundo, I'm sorry, can't make it. We're doing everything we can. We'll be establishing the Bat Segundo Legal Defense Fund to prepare for his inevitable extradition. However, in the meantime, please enjoy part two of our Alternative Press Expo coverage. We have a lot of interviews here, and I apologize that the young roving correspondent failed completely to pronounce Dan Klaus's name correctly. So, apologies to Mr. Klaus, apologies to listeners, apologies to comic book fans everywhere. I know, this will burst your bubble. I sure would be delighted with your company. Come on and do the jail, hard rock, it'll be flat rock. Okay, so I'm here with Anna Borsig, who has a book here called Dorothy. Maybe you could tell us about it.
Hi, it's Dorothy is our photo comic. It's a modern reimagining of The Wizard of Oz, except dark and twisted. And basically we're taking the concept of Baum's books, not the movie, and following the general spine of the first six books, except we've come up with our own characters and our own mini story arcs to go off that golden path.
So at what point do you sort of diverge from L. Frank Baum or even Ruth Bader Thompson?
Page one.
Really? So then where do you diverge in terms of Oz?
Well, right away, our Dorothy is a 16-year-old punk rocker with a chip on her shoulder, and instead of getting caught up in a twister because she's frazzled having come home from running away, she's hotwired Uncle Henry's truck to go find some drugs in Topeka. And the storm picks her up on her way. She doesn't want to go home to Kansas. She doesn't want to be in Oz. She doesn't want to be anywhere. So in the book and in the movie, she wants to go home to Aunt Em and Uncle Henry. And in our concept, she doesn't feel at home there at all.
Does she feel at home in Oz? Or?
No, there's no Starbucks.
So is there a Toto in this? Or?
There is. Actually, I'll show you chapter two. This is our flying monkey, very scary. And this is our Toto. And our concept...
he's Abo then, basically.
Yeah, he's a little robot dog. In our concept, Dorothy's come 100 years ahead from Baum's book, so that she's a modern 16-year-old girl using modern language. And Oz has also come forward 100 years. And so there's flying robots. There's a lot more futuristic science fiction world in Oz. It's not the Oz of our youth.
But is there any sort of, like, one of the nice things about Oz, the books, I know, is that there's a lot of innocence in there. I mean, there's TikTok, man, of course, technologically. I mean, do you have an answer for that? And also, what about, like, Oz isn't all, you know, evil, you know?
Right, no, and Oz isn't all scary in our books either. I am not the writer. I am the executive producer, and I'm kind of kept in the dark about the future chapters. I believe our writer said he's going to touch on TikTok, but we're not using every single character from the Baum books. I don't know how to go from there. We have a good witch, and she gives Dorothy actually a magic necklace instead of magic shoes. And she nearly gets killed by a dragon. She finally meets the scarecrow, and they stumble into Munchkin land. And that's the ending of chapter 5, is her leaving Munchkin land. So we haven't even met the so-called lion and the so-called tin man, who in our book are very different kinds of characters.
Now, when you say you're the executive producer and the writers are mysteriously not here, you're the wizard behind the curtain. Well, what does that entail exactly?
Well, actually, we self-publish, and there's four of us who own the company. And there's Greg Menino, who's the lead artist and the main creator. And then there's Mark Masterson, who's the writer. He's extremely well-read, and so he's trying to use as many references from Baum for people who are huge Oz fans. But he went out to lunch, so that's why he's not here right now. And then my husband, Ray Borsig, he is the lead CG artist, because there's a lot of computer graphic effects in our books. It's not hand-drawn at all. It's live-action photography, computer graphics, 3D models, and practical models all composited together with Photoshop.
Why photos over illustrations?
Because Greg really wanted this to be a movie, but movies are expensive, and comic books are less.
Really?
Yeah, just a tad. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Gandhi!
Okay. So I am here with two gentlemen who have a Gumby booth here. First of all, what are your names and what is going on here? You have the Gumby rights or what's the deal?
My name's Mel Smith, and yes, we have the Gumby rights.
My name's Clark Castile, and we're publishing it under our company, Wildcard Inc.
Okay. Well, why Gumby? What's been going on with Gumby? How did you get the rights and all that, and what's happening here?
The whole thing just came about. I knew Bob Burden. He's a friend of mine for many years. He wrote the original series in the 80s. I just happened to, a year ago at Comic-Con, brought it up to his attention to say, hey, would you be willing to rewrite the Gumby series that you did in the 80s? And he just nonchalantly said, get the license. So it took me about 3 months to locate it, because Gumby's been underground for a while. Contacted him, worked out the contracts, and here we are now, almost a year later, with the first issue ready to hit the stores.
And Bob, you're writing this then?
I'm Clark.
Clark, I'm sorry.
Bob Burden is writing it.
Bob Burden's writing it, and Rick Geary's doing the art. Okay. And we have Steve Olof and Lance
Board
doing the coloring, and we're doing the publishing.
What take are you bringing on Gumby that hasn't been seen before? What makes your Gumby better than all the other sort of, you know, adaptations?
I think the fact that Bob's bringing to the story is a whole different perspective. You don't get stuck in toy land. He's taking it into more of a realistic, surreal Ally McBeal kind of sense to Gumby.
Ally McBeal sense.
Yes.
Sex in the City sense.
No Sex in the City, but Ally McBeal has the talking baby kind of stuff, so it integrates fantasy with reality. Like, it's almost like a Groucho Marx.
So Gumby's biological clock is ticking? What?
Well, hey, in the first issue, he's got a crush. So there's girls, you know, he gets the... you got me on that one, buddy.
I mean, well, hey, you're the one who presented the dancing baby. We all know what that...
As I saw it, you know, I mean, it's a good representation of Bob's writing style. You know, it's Gumby, but not stuck in the parameters of the 60s or 80s series. You know, in the 60s and 80s, it was more Gumby Friends adventures. Now you're branching out and you're seeing more to what could be to the character. You know, he's involving more feelings, situations. New characters, a whole new slew of characters. So, you know, we're not stuck with the, Prickle and Goo and all the Woolly Mammoth characters. Now we're going more towards these new, innovative, fresh looks.
A darker Gumby and a darker Pokey, I presume?
I wouldn't even say darker. I would say definitely...
More updated.
Yeah, more...
More updated, to more into the mainstream of today, you know. It's got a bunch of different facets of everything, I suppose.
I'm just wondering, though, how Frank Miller you're getting here with Gumby.
No, not that Frank Miller. We're not taking away weapons or anything like that.
As you can see, we had dark Gumby. No, actually, so funny, this Frank Miller, interesting. The second issue does kind of have some neat little things like that, but I wouldn't say so much Frank Miller. I mean, again... If you're familiar with Bob Burden's writing on Flaming Carrot and stuff like that, then you get an idea of what he's doing to Gumby and Pokey to boot. You know, like in the second issue, you know, Gumby has to save Pokey. So I don't want to spoil it, but it's a very interesting, you know, Gumby actually suffers from amnesia, and he goes along a journey with some hobos in the second issue.
You go for the amnesia device in the second issue?
You're pulling all the punches quick. But you know, I think it's great. I mean, again, when you read a Bob Burden story, you get so much out of it. You know, you get humor, you get seriousness, you get, did he really do that? On anything he writes, anything can happen, and it does. And now he's got Gumby to play with, and he's doing it.
Anything can happen with Gumby.
Yeah, which is what Art Clokey did. I mean, if you really think about it, Art Clokey, when he wrote those early TV episodes, they were bedtime stories for his children. So they weren't preempted, scripted, made up, thought of. They were just certainly things that he just said to his kids and then took it and transcribed it to what we knew as Gumby. Bob Burden is a perfect example of that, a guy who just writes like Peter Pan. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, just these tales come out of him that are just childlike and yet filled with things that you wouldn't suspect that are intertwined. I mean, again, in the first issue, we got these maniacal clowns. You know, Gumby releases these clowns from a cage, thinking that they're being, you know, mistreated, and all of a sudden mayhem ensues amongst all of the town that he's involved with. And so, you know, that's typical Bob. You just get these great stories that a seven-year-old could pick up and just get a kick out of, or a seven-year-old could pick up and get a kick out of. I mean, it's just such a tale of just craziness. So, you know.
Can you back this up?
Well, back it up.
Back this shit up, yo.
Hey, well, you know. How can I back that up? Along with that, you got Rick Geary, whose style is so flowing. I mean, he brings real life to the character. I don't know what else to say.
It's not even so much real life to the character. I think Rick brings, of course, this line art that is reminiscent of the, you know, the 70s, 80s kind of quality.
How are you restylizing Gumby in this comic? I mean, you mentioned line art and all that. I mean, is Gumby having a sort of slight redesign to him? Or?
No, actually, we're keeping him to the vintage 60s. That was a request right out of PrimaVision. You know, that was something that they specifically wanted, was a look that he needed to have, and we managed to get it for him. I mean, that's something that back in the past, for like the last 20 years, they would do Gumby doing anything. Gumby with, you know, shampoo bottles, Gumby with the wrong hump on the wrong side. Different looks, different feels. Even this Gumby's incorrect. But, you know, that was one thing that we worked with them. They wanted a certain look, certain feel, yeah, so we gave it to them.
The Gumby here looks terribly constipated.
You would too if you're on a ledge.
Yeah, I think so. I think, wouldn't we all?
But it's kind of neat. This one was drawn after a story that Bob did in the 80s that never saw print, which is similar to that Dark Knight you were talking about. So I would love one day to rehash that story, but
the Dark Green Man Returns,
and not picking wise either. So, but yeah, you know, revamping him in a certain look. I think the best way we could do that is by the stories. The stories serve that purpose. I mean, when you look at it, Gumby, of course, everybody knows what Gumby looks like, whether it be Eddie Murphy or the Dark Knight Gumby. You know, stick a gum Gumby, but the one thing I think that sets it up to the par is the stories. And when you read the stories, you're going to find out that you're going to enjoy them. Everybody can enjoy them. You know, it has so much in there. It takes the TV show up a bump. So if you're a fan of the TV show, read the stories, because Gumby will look the same, but the stories are going to be different.
And it's a real-life biological clock, Ally McBeal Gumby.
Yes. Well, like you said, if you're a fan of Ally McBeal and the way it's written, you'll really like the way Gumby's written, because like I said, the writing on Ally McBeal is similar to Bob's style of writing. You know, when Bob Burton writes, again, it's like the Groucho Marx, where he's, you know, where the bomb comes through the window and out the other window, and you know, Groucho Marx goes, "Oh my God, we got to shut the window." You know, that's what could happen in a Gumby episode. Anything can happen. It's just Ally McBeal. Anything can happen in an Ally McBeal episode. It doesn't set to a normal precedence.
Robert Downey Jr. could show up in this Gumby, huh?
Sure. Well,
anything could happen, you're saying?
Literally, I did say that, and it could, you know. And if Robert Downey wants to come on in for a page or two, have his agent call me.
Well, thanks a lot, man.
Hey, thanks, brother.
Sure. Okay, so I'm here at the Dickhead Comics booth, and they have an offering here called Hard Gay Comics, which is extended to 3 issues. Maybe you could tell me about this.
About myself?
About yourself, about Hard Gay Comics. Well, give me the pitch. What's so great about Hard Gay Comics, aside from the fact that they're hard and gay?
And Hard Gay Comics is really exciting. It's too hard. And this comic is...
Too hard, huh?
Yeah. This comic is not for only, you know, straight people, for everybody. Yeah.
What's, aside from the fact that they're hard and gay, what other things are in these comics?
What?
Besides the fact that these comics are hard and gay, what other things can we expect out of these?
I think it's, you know, that depends on people, you know, how you feel, my comic book. Yeah, but you know, I just want to show my comic to everybody, and I want people to remember my company and my comic book. So.
Certainly, Hard Gay Comics is a way to get people to remember.
Yeah, now everybody knows my comic book. So.
And your friend here is also part of Hard Gay Comics. Oh, she's a fag hag. Okay, that's she has a T-shirt. What's your role in this besides the obvious?
I am helping, like lettering and digital work. Part of that's all. So he's not. He draws it, put the colors, everything, and the stories. But I just do the editing and you know the positioning and.
So it could be said that you were one of the masterminds behind this because you get everything sort of like, you know, honed and edited right.
Yeah. I'm just like following his original work. I don't put any my, you know, I don't know.
Do you folks have names or?
What?
What's your name? I didn't catch it.
My name is Shuji Karathara.
Gotcha. Why did you settle on Dickhead Comics? Did you really want to get people's attention? Or?
What?
The name Dickhead Comics. Did you just really want to get people's attention here?
Yeah, I think so. And because it is to remember, Dickhead Comics.
There's also a very strong association with the whole hard gay aspect.
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. Okay, so I am here with Neil Jam, who has the Neil Jam Invasion, the Neil Jam Adventure. If there's one common sort of motif to all of your covers, the name Neil Jam is quite prominent. Perhaps you can talk about what's in this.
Well, I am the one and only Neil Jam, as you may have guessed. Neil Jam, aside from me, is my own personal cartoon universe. I have a regular cast of characters. Everybody has the trademark big black eyeballs. That's how you know it's Neil Jam. And it is kind of a mix of the absurd with the mundane. It's got something for everybody, I like to think.
What makes the Neil Jam universe one of a kind, distinct?
One of a kind? Well, it's got a boldness, I think, that nobody has. It's got a realness. It's got humor that it's the mix that I think people need in their comics lives.
And the working knowledge here is to refer to it as the Neil Jam universe. Why not just call it a name that's just a universe? I'm just curious why you personalized it.
Well, I am Neil Jam. Like, you can call me Neil or you call me Neil Jam.
Can I call you Mr. Jam?
You can. I prefer Neil.
Really? Because you might be confused with a cousin named Raspberry. I'm sorry. You probably get that a lot.
Well,
But I mean, seriously, why personalize it? Why call it the Neil Jam universe as opposed to Narnia or, you know, Middle Earth?
Well, actually, it was called Neil Jam, but it was kind of there was no reason for that. And eventually, I started calling the land that they lived in they live in Neil Jam. So that's the name of wherever they live, whether it's their town or their country or their planet. They live in Neil Jam, so I don't know. That's just what it is, you know.
But how do you, like, say, get directions to a party in Neil Jam if everything's named Neil Jam?
You just come over to my house, man. Come on. What's with these questions?
No, I'm serious. I want to understand what Neil Jam is.
Neil Jam is raw. It's a primal thing, okay?
But I mean, if Neil Jam is universal, it's got to be, you know, you have to refer to things differently. Like, if you go to Neil Jam Avenue and make a right on Neil Jam Avenue and then make another left on Neil Jam Avenue, it's going to be confusing after a while.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, that's why I got a cast of characters. Each one has a distinct personality. So there's distinct separate entities inside of the world that is Neil Jam. It's not all the same thing.
Now, are these characters, you know, are they cognizant? Is there a sort of meta element here where they know who you, Neil Jam, is? Or?
They don't really know who I am. They just know the greater stuff that is going on. They know they're a part of something special, that's for sure.
Is there some sort of religion in this Neil Jam universe? Or?
Well, I don't really like to talk about it in that sense, but Neil Jam is kind of like a state of mind. It's a way of life, so.
But if the state of mind is confused with, like, the place you live in, that's got to be quite an existential dilemma.
Well, yeah, that's what makes Neil Jam so special. It means so many different things to so many different people. Come on.
And I noticed also that the colors you use are very bright and vibrant, at least on the covers, and also the style inside this is very, very kind of, you know, heavy lines. So maybe you can talk about that.
Well, yeah, that is, the boldness is something I like to try to go for. I like the classic style of just, even though it's for everybody, I don't do it for kids, but I like to have it look like it's this classic cartooniness, you know, with bright colors and bold cartooning. So it's just what I like to do. It's what I'm good at.
Well, thank you, Neil Jam, creator of Neil Jam, and I will thank you. Jacob Steingroot? Steingroot. Okay, Jacob Steingroot of the man behind the mini-comic Zod. Maybe you can tell me about this.
Well, Zod started just as a way to kill time. The first four issues are just drawings of little animals that I drew by hand, colored in my computer, and printed out and sold in any store that would carry it. And I eventually decided to, they started selling, so I decided to add some little flourishes. The fifth issue was a Romeo and Juliet inspired story where an adorable little cat and dog fall in love and the chaos that comes about through that. And then I've been doing little comics since then. I'm on issue 7 now. Issue 7 is the first part in the Odyssey story, which takes place in space. It's about a monkey and a tiger trying to return home from their space exploration and the adventures that happen to them.
I noticed that King Kong is on the cover of one of these here. What's up with that?
I was doing different issues that, like, the first issue was cats and dogs. The second one had a bunch of birds. I wanted to do a monkey issue, and I thought what better for the cover of the monkey issue than King Kong on the Empire State Building. So I got a picture of that and covered up the actual King Kong with a drawing of my interpretation of King Kong.
Now, so the Odyssey comic that you were mentioning, what is, that's, is that based off of Homer, or is that your own kind of spin, or is that based more on 2001, or what?
It's based off of Homer, but it takes place in outer space, and it has little animals in all the roles. It's loosely based on Homer. I mean, we've got Odysseus, and he's trying to return home. We've got Penelope, who's at home and being courted by suitors, who in this version are numerous penguins. And we've got his son trying to look for him and going out into space to search for his dad, just like Homer had. But Homer had him in the sea, and I have them in outer space.
Well, how are you going to get the Homeric epithets and the bitchy gods and all that? I mean, how have you factored this into the great master plan?
I haven't really factored that into the master plan, but I figure, you know, Homer had all that great stuff, and I've got adorable little animals and full-color comics. So we each have the tools that we work with.
But no gods.
But I'm not sure about the gods yet. I'm not sure what I'm going to do. Poseidon plays such an important role that I feel like he should be some sort of giant fish or octopus or something and get in there at some point.
Question for you. Is General Zod an influence on Zod?
When I did the first issue, which I thought would basically just be something I'd hand out to friends, I was going through a big Terrence Stamp phase. He played General Zod in the Superman movies.
And he ran for president a couple of times, I understand.
Yes, I've heard that General Zod is running in 2008 as president or leader of the human race or what have you. I'm a big Terrence Stamp fan, and that kind of, the name Zod kind of had a ring to it, so I decided to appropriate that, and hopefully DC Comics won't shut me down.
You know, Zod is Doze spelled backwards. Maybe that could be your defense.
That could be, yes. Doze spelled backwards. Yes.
Or it could be Dawes. I don't know. You could change it around. Like, Dawes is your version of Oz. I don't know.
I actually had someone who thought the comic book was called Oz for a while. So, yeah. And they kept saying, I love Oz. And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. And eventually I figured out they meant the comic book that I was doing called Zod. Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks so much.
Great. What's the score?
Hang on one sec.
Should you be
okay, so I am at a table with something called Fart Party Comics, and I'm sorry, what's your name?
Julia Wirtz.
Okay, Julia, well, what is Fart Party Comics? Give us the nutshell. What is it? What is your angle?
They're autobiographical comics that are just about me and my life, like in San Francisco. And the Fart Party is just a name I came up with because I couldn't think of anything else when I was trying to do my web address.
Are these scatological in nature, or what?
Not really. There's a few, one or two, that are. You know, they're pretty inappropriate, immature humor, but, you know.
Why? I notice you have a bike there. Are you a messenger, or what's the situation?
I'm not a bike messenger, but my boyfriend is, and we're both really into biking, so we wanted to make a collaborative comic that I got some other people to give me comics about bikes.
And why a fart party in particular? What is it about flatulence that sort of, you know, that is your muse?
Because, you know, farting's always funny, even if people don't, you know, like my mom thinks it's inappropriate, but everyone laughs when someone farts, so I figured... And if I can get more people to look at the name because they think that it's disgusting, then, which people actually have, you know, just because of the name, looked at the comic. So it's kind of a way to get attention, I guess.
Well, you didn't faze me. I saw Fart Party and I came right to this table.
Good. That's what I'm trying to do.
So there's more to it than just farts here. Just to go ahead and set it straight for the record here.
Yeah. There's a lot. You know, it's actually mostly disgustingly cute comics about my relationship with my boyfriend and my friends. But I tried not to do them too cutesy, but they kind of came out that way.
And how many issues? It looks like you have two here? Or?
I have just one Fart Party one and one collaborative one. There's actually two of these, but I'm only selling number one right now.
So you're based locally then?
Yeah, I live in San Francisco. And these are mostly on the web right now at fartparty.org. So that's where you can find most of them.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Julie. Yeah.
Meu coração faz tica, tica, bum, tchim. E vem a saudade.
Okay, so I am here with Carmen Ogden.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Yes, and what would you like me to say?
Oh, I'm sorry. Anyway, yeah, I got so concerned with Bizet. Anyway... So you have a comic here called Submarine File. Maybe you can tell me about it.
Absolutely. I'd be delighted to tell you about it, Edward. The Submarine File...
You can call me Ed, by the way.
Ed. It takes place on a submarine, and it's this kind of dysfunctional crew and all of their bad communication and strange things they discover and personality conflicts and food allergies all are here in the submarine.
Food allergies on the submarine?
Absolutely.
I mean, they've probably got limited rations on there.
Yeah. It's tricky. It's tricky for the wheat allergic person.
So what was it about submarines that kind of struck your fancy that became your muse?
I love the movie Hunt for Red October. And when I was 8, my father took me to visit the USS Pampanito right here at the harbor. And I was like, I fell in love with the interior. Like the claustrophobia of it and like the gauges everywhere are like so like, I don't know, it's like it like made me crazy. Like I like drawing gauges and I don't know, so it like really stayed with me. And so I was meditating at church and I started drawing. And all of a sudden I was drawing all these submarine pictures and I'm like, this is so cool, I want to do more of this. That was 2 years ago.
Okay, so who is the specific kind of protagonist of Submarine File?
Well, there are two main protagonists. Madeline and William, and William's the captain, but he doesn't really have a lot of power because he's kind of a wimpy guy. And Madeline and William kind of like stumble through the whole process of keeping on a submarine. And there's also a villain. Were you going to ask about villains?
Yes, I was, but I was, you know, I was letting you tell the story here.
And so there's a villain. He's introduced in this one right here, number 1711899, and it's Prester John, and he's like. Has ambiguous sexuality, and he's kind of like predatory and scary in a lot of ways. And he has bad taste in art.
I'm looking at, you know, you just mentioned a very large number. Where was the starting point of the number? How did this like, let's see, we've got like 10 digits here or something?
Well, it's an aesthetic number. This is only like the fifth one, but I didn't want to say just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's like really boring. I wanted to have like... Big, like, I wanted military, big, impossible military serial numbers on everything that I possibly could, including the front covers.
Esperando, what's this here?
Oh, this is a one I produced for my church, actually. They wanted art for the Advent show for Christmas. And so I couldn't really introduce, like, a whole lot of Christmassy elements, but in the season of Advent, there's a waiting, a theme of waiting and expectation. So it's mostly they're going crazy waiting for communication that never comes.
For a moment there, I was thinking Advent was sort of a play on words or something.
Like adventure?
Well, there's that. I was thinking like the vent in a submarine.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it has the word vente, which is wind, and it blows, and there's definitely that in there as well. And Esperanto is Spanish for hoping and waiting.
It's also Esperanto for I don't know what you're talking about.
Exactly.
I don't know if you knew that, but.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
Okay. Well, I just learned about it. We can learn from each other. That's what APE is all about. Okay. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ed.
There's no way in hell we'd allow this country to push its genocidal consensus on our homelands. This ignorance exists, but it can be destroyed. Niggas talk about change and working within the system to achieve that. The problem with always being a conformist is that when you try to change the system from within, it's not you who changes the system.
So I'm here with Fred VanLente, who has a comic here called Action Philosophers. Maybe you could tell me about this.
I'd love to. Action Philosophers won the Zurich Grant in 2004, and ever since then we've been inflicting on the world our version of the lives and thoughts of history's A-list brain trust, told in a hip and humorous fashion. And we do three thinkers per issue, each with a theme. We have Self-Help for Stupid Ugly Losers, which is Freud, Jung, and Joseph Campbell. Our latest issue is called Hate the French, which we flambé René Descartes, who of course came up with I Think, Therefore I Am, Jean-Paul Sartre, and the deconstructinator, Jacques Derrida.
So it's all the complainers, basically.
Exactly. But we let them have it with our award-winning combination of insightful graphical commentary and bathroom humor.
Award-winning? What did you win?
We won the Zurich Award, and we were nominated for an Ignatz last year at SPX 05.
Okay, and to what extent is this book have action? Maybe you can describe.
I mean, what put the action into the Action Philosophers for?
I mean, partly it's a gag, obviously. It's an eye-catching title. But it's also because thinking really is an action. And what our biographies focus on, or what are the life experiences that different thinkers did to come up with their own, you know, their philosophies. I mean, and it's quite often very exciting. You know, Jean-Paul Sartre came up with his philosophy in a German POW camp, you know. Descartes was a soldier, and he came up with his philosophy while serving in the army. And so, you know, you might not think of philosophy as being active, but it is.
Also, action, too. I mean, you know, really serious, like, you know, seriously, blood and guts and, like, bare-knuckle fights.
Oh, yeah, you know, totally. It's we were going to have a smackdown, you know, for or against the existence of God, you know. And, you know, it's sort of in the realm of Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics. You know, you can do a lot of fun, comedic stuff, action like, you know, how you were describing, in order to get across some of these very complex ideas through pictures.
Is right.
Well, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Edward.
Is Christmas safe? Is Christmas safe for animals? Soft and squishy animated.
Hey, so I'm here with a gentleman who has identified that he has the only Christmas story in April here at APE. What's your name and why a Christmas story in April?
Well, my name's Matt Voss from Voss Hog Productions, and I put out a Christmas story because I basically missed my deadline for last Christmas, so I got it on the market here. It's called A Croquet Christmas, and it's written in a rhyming couplet form, and I actually did it with my dad. My dad wrote the poem, and I did the artwork.
I was going to ask who Robert Voss was here. That's your dad.
Yep.
And what came first, the artwork or the poem?
Good question. I guess it all started from a sketch, like most stuff do, just doodling in class, and came up with a funky picture of Santa Claus, and I decided to make a comic about it.
How did croquet and Christmas sort of come together here? That's a pretty intense little cover you got there.
Yeah, well, the story goes that Santa becomes sick, or he has health problems, and so Bob the elf, this evil elf, takes over, and he's a businessman, and he decides that he's going to cut corners and make everything easy, so he decides that he's going to, all the good little girls and boys are going to get identical matching croquet sets, and all the bad kids are going to get coal, and he makes a huge profit and hires a bunch of imp toady bullies, and it's got some fighting at the end, and it's got a lot of action. It's all ages, and people should enjoy it.
I'm a little terrified of the cover here because Santa's here of a croquet mallet whipping the hell out of something here.
Dude, check it out. You'll like it.
Hey, Matt. Well, thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
I am here at a table occupied by M.K. Reed. A pale fire caught my eye because I'm a Nabokov fan. But maybe you can. But who is this? What's the situation here with Matthew E. Hawkins? Maybe you can talk about what your stuff is all about.
Well, Matthew's stuff. He's my boyfriend, and he has just the most random things happen to him, and they're like totally crazy stories. I just illustrated one for him in the new one, where he was getting dinner and someone asked him for a penny, but they like slapped him on the arm, so he got pissed off of them and he said no. And then as he was leaving they got into a sort of confrontation, and he was called cheap ass Mr. No Penny. So,
but they can't be nearly as fantastic as Pale Fire and Catfight.
They hardly compare.
They pale in comparison.
they're good, but they're not as good as the high ticket items here. Pale Fire, I just finished a week ago, and it's about a teenage girl who has a crush on a guy who everyone else says is an arsonist, and her denial of that.
Denial, huh? Why is she in denial?
Teenage girls, you know, they like someone, they don't want to hear anything about what you've got to say. It's all hormones and no logic, so.
And Catfight here looks decidedly more pugilistic.
Catfight kind of relates to that. It's about three high school girls, and one of them gets a boyfriend, and she's the first one to do that, and then it everything with her friends kind of goes nuts. And there's fighting, so.
And what is Jumbo Ice exactly?
I worked on an Italian ice truck at the Jersey Shore for 2 summers, and there's an essay that covers the first summer, and then there's a comic of a little thing that happened during the second summer.
Oh, but which you can't reveal here.
Well,
you have to get the book.
It's a tale of revenge. And other than that, you have to get the book.
Now, you're playing up the arson angle, and I don't think I've seen a single comic yet that has been very arson-centric with this Pale Fire thing. What is it about fire?
It's fun to draw, and it's pretty also very easy to draw because you just do these little swishy lines, and you can add some smoke, which is more swishy lines, and it's fun, and I kind of came up with the idea when I was barbecuing in my backyard.
Staring at fire? Are you a pyromaniac?
No, I was just trying to eat dinner, but there was fire, and then a fire truck just happened to go past the house, and it kind of came together, and it borrows from the theme of the original Pale Fire.
Really? There's like footnotes in this? Or?
There's no footnotes. That I originally thought it would be really funny to try and do something, to try and adapt that, because I was like, there's no way anyone could ever do like a movie of this or anything, even though the story is so great. So I kind of completely abandoned the story and the footnotes and everything, but it shares a theme.
But is there some sort of deranged poet at the beginning? Or?
No, but there should be, but there isn't.
Well, then what does it share in common with the Nabokov book?
Mm-hmm.
What does it share in common with the Nabokov book?
It shares that kind of misinformation, reading something really the wrong way theme, which is, I don't know, you really have to have read Pale Fire and, you know, got...
Oh, I've read it, oh yeah. I just want to know what to possibly expect here.
Fire, willful denial, and...
But no footnote.
No footnotes, no. Although there is an essay at the end that you could kind of consider.
But there should be. You know, do you think there should be more footnotes in comics?
There probably should be. But it's hard to, like, do that because usually you have to put them at the end of the page and then you have to shrink the page and it kind of throws the proportion out of whack. And so...
You could always go end notes as well.
Yes.
No one's done that, you know? You could be the first.
It could be.
We go down like moles, claws dig an endless hole. We descend on fours, our snouts lead us on. We fall down.
Okay, so
I am here with Gary Zumi, and what attracted me to this table was the fact that there are lots of animals here. So maybe you can talk about your work here and what you have.
This is a collection of my self-published work, and I try a lot of different printing techniques on my books, from linoleum block printing to letterpress to silkscreen to GoCo printing. And a lot of the content of the work has to do with social commentary, human nature. There's some political commentary, but it's not the main focus of the work.
And animals is sort of your major theme here. What attracts you to animals?
I like dogs. Yeah, I've got a couple of books on dogs, The Year of the Dog and Best in Show. Grew up with dogs, and they're just always been around.
Are they the sort of, you know, means for the social commentary, or?
You could find that in there, but that's not really what you find. That's not the first thing you think about when you see the books on dogs.
Besides animals, what else do you have here?
Well, I've got also photography books, and they range from the suburban landscapes to a book on air raid sirens of LA County. I also have a handmade letterpress book, which is based on the myth of Perseus and Medusa.
Well, thanks so much, Garrett.
Thank you.
Hard to be a girl, so nice to be a boy. In my room at night, not a pretty sight. Here's an empty
kiss. So I'm here with Brandon Higgins, who has a book here called Stop Dating. So is this a warning, an exercise? What is this?
Well, it was inspired by a relationship that I didn't have with a girl. It's co-edited by my friend David Besant and myself. And basically, the idea is that you'll read these dating horror stories, laugh a little bit, and then understand that you probably should just stay at home and masturbate. It might be easier for you than dating.
So this is an anti-dating sort of situation.
Indeed, yeah. Stop dating. We don't think it might be right for everybody, but a lot of comic people, maybe.
So this is almost similar to abstinence, though.
Maybe. Yeah, I guess you can look at it that way. I mean, the basic idea is just to kind of laugh at all of our mishaps and basically say maybe dating isn't... if you're going to do it, maybe try it unconventionally. I'm not sure how that would work, but whatever you've done before, try not to do it again.
Have you personally stopped dating? How long has it been for you?
Oh, no, I have a girlfriend.
Oh, so wait a second here. Then you're actually actually in the process of dating. So in what... I'm getting the sense, are you trying to sort of, you know, whittle down the competition? What's going on here?
I'm really crappy at being by myself, and so I usually have long-term relationships rather than just kind of dating. I've never really actually gone out and casually dated. If I meet a girl and we talk, I'll ask her out, but it will normally be sort of like, yeah, either we're going to kind of hang out or we're not, but I don't really want that kind of disillusion of not knowing whether she likes me or maybe she does. So I just get it out of the way right away. I don't date. I just ask questions like, are you into me? And should we go out more? I don't know if that's dating, maybe.
It kind of is, I think. But, you know, we don't call it dating. But then what makes you the sort of expert to talk about this topic when you're practicing the reverse here?
Well, I'm certainly not the expert. Our co-editor, David Besson, he's definitely better sort of staying on his own and keeping with the stop dating idea. I think the basic concept behind it is just to kind of say, yeah, we all have had a lot of odd stories, and it's fun to share them and sort of in a light way, but at the same time kind of express that dating is really tough, and you might consider stopping. I haven't stopped, but you might want to.
This is sounding very distressingly like a 12-step program.
Yeah, I'm not... I don't know. It's a tough world, right? Being single, like, who wants to do it? And I'm actually going to get a tattoo tonight, I think, from my friend who's here, and she has a story in here. I'm going to get a tattoo that says, "Everyone is either making love or else expecting rain," which is a Bob Dylan quote. And I think that definitely goes with this a little bit, you know? Like, either you're in love or you're not. And when you're not, life can suck. But, you know...
I don't know, but then if you're comfortably alone, and you know, dating can be really fun, it doesn't have to, like, occupy your mindset. Maybe it's a specific kind of, you know, audience you have for this. Is that...
I totally think you're right, yeah, for sure, man, yeah.
All right, well, thanks so much.
That was funny. Yeah.
Well, they called me once, and they called me twice. Third time they called me, it was cold as ice. They say, get to the table.
I'm here with Sean Seamus McWinney.
That's right, Sean Seamus McWinney.
Good, I pronounced it correctly. You have two books here, Diary of a Catering Whore, which is probably what caught my eye. The word whore seems to do that.
Yes, that seems to catch people's eye, that right away, the name.
And you also have one called Head Trip. Maybe you can talk about these two books.
Yeah, Head Trip, that's also autobiographical, dealing with my dad with Alzheimer's. And kind of his progression with that and how it affects everybody around that environment. Diary of a Catering Whore is a little bit more humorous, but it's my observations from my day job in catering and that struggling artist and seeing the ironic, bizarre situations.
And you're still alive and actually having the catering thing. I see a lot of catering people and they're just really insane.
They're pretty tore up, yeah. Yes. I'm trying not to get there at that point. So.
Is the sort of these comics sort of one step for you to kind of stay sane in that environment? Or?
Well, it gives me almost a way to use that experience and not feel like my life is wasting away when I'm there. So.
What kind of tales are in Diary of a Catering Whore?
There's three tales collected. One is called Uber Cool and dealing with a crazy kind of tech, kind of media party that's insane and people are very grabby, needy. And another one is dealing with a wedding at the Legion of Honor and the kind of irony of a lot of like caterers who are artists and gay, and the weddings are straight weddings, and yet we're not allowed to get married, but we have to serve at these strangers' weddings, and it's just kind of wrong. And the other one is about meeting someone you know at a catering party that you know from online, but you meet them, you see them at this catering event, and the awkwardness of relating.
Wait, so people are hooking up at these catering events?
Well, you hook up online, but then you run into them at a catering event. You never know who you're going to see at a catering event.
Oh, do they know who you are?
Well, that's the question. Usually, sometimes, but anything goes at a catering thing. That's why it makes for a great story, you know, because you never know what's going to happen. Different characters, different elements every time. So,
I had no idea that catering was so salacious here.
Oh, it's very incestuous a lot of ways too, among the staff especially. So.
Wow. Okay. Well, thanks so much, Sean.
Thank you.
And I've got my false superstition, but do I know how to act? I got no silent ambition, but does it make me a man?
So I am here with Shannon Garrity.
Shannon Garrity, yeah.
Shannon Garrity, I'm sorry, who has Narbonic. Maybe you can tell me about Narbonic.
It's an online comic strip I've been doing for about 6 years now. It's at narbonic.com, also at Modern Tales. And I have two book collections of it out now, with a third on the way.
Okay, well, what is Narbonic? What is the hook here?
It's a daily comic strip about mad scientists.
Ah, mad scientists. Any real life inspiration?
No, I'm a failed biology major.
Okay. I mean, what any sort of inspiration for why scientists are mad? Or is it your own insanity? I don't know.
I just like mad scientists. I'm sorry, I don't really have a catchier explanation at all.
No, that's okay.
It's basically just a conglomeration of stuff that I like to draw.
And how long has this comic been going on online?
It's into its sixth year now. It's going to be ending at the end of this year.
Wow. Is it generating any revenue for you? Or?
I'm sorry, what?
Is it generating any cash for you? Or?
Yeah, small amounts. It's on moderntales.com, which is a subscription-based webcomic site. And obviously, I also have books. So it's a little side thing for me.
And how many sort of ways have you managed to explore mad scientists over the year?
Okay, the main character is a sort of evil geneticist, and most of the strip is about, just a stab at her laboratory.
Cool. Well, thanks so much, Shana. All right. So I am here at the B-Minus Comics booth. because a gentleman accosted me and asked me why I didn't interview him, and he's not here. So I'm going to interview everyone at the B-Minus Comics Books booth but him. So who are you guys, and what is B-Minus Comics?
I'm Joe Canose.
I'm A.K. Smith.
And I'm an artist, producer for B-Minus.
And B-Minus Comics has about five plus different comic book titles. We have a DVD and a TV show. It's a late night horror variety show called Hell and Ice. It's in San Francisco and like seven different cities across the country.
We also produce an animated series called The Serialists about Buck's serial characters who are serial killers.
And what's this Hell on Ice business here?
Hell on Ice is the name of our show.
It started as a comic book. It's an anthology book with short stories, and Ms. Monster was the character that kind of hosted the book. And it developed into the TV show, which is a late-night horror variety show, sort of like an Elvira meets Pee-wee's Playhouse meets
pretty much Puppet
Mystery
Gore,
Science Theater. Yeah.
Yeah. B-movies.
Animation. Local
shorts.
Bands.
Meets creature.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. The whole, you know, B-movie thrill. And there's live-action gore, which is one of my favorite parts of the show.
And animated gore.
Yes.
which is one of my favorite parts.
Where does the show air?
It airs in San Francisco every second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 12 a.m.
What channel, though?
Channel 29, which is our cable access channel here. It's also in Berkeley and a bunch of... You can go to the website, b-comics.com.
Yeah, we also sell DVDs of the show.
Okay, I'm sorry, I don't have cable, I don't watch TV.
We actually don't have cable either, but you can buy the DVD too.
Yeah, you don't need cable. You just need rabbit ears.
Yes.
And you got the show.
And it's hosted by Ms. Monster and her Monster Melons, which are two melons, Tit and Tat, and they're bringers of the apocalypse.
Now, there's a giant green creature here with tennis shoes.
Over there.
Yeah, he's a monster melon. He and his...
And he's a puppet, but don't tell him that.
Yeah. They are the harbingers of doom.
Yes. Of doom and mayhem. They're always eating flesh and fans in
they're
my living
to,
room.
They're always up to no good, but they manage to only end up hurting themselves.
Essentially.
So you're essentially, I'm getting a definitive horror vibe from you. I mean, what's your spin on horror that makes you a B-minus comics no different from, I mean, different from everybody else? different is what I mean to say. I'm sorry. You're like interview number 20 million, okay?
What makes us different? Well, I don't know. We like to get our gore on, and we get our gore on good. It's pretty much, I think the show is different because it has a whole, it's like for the ADD generation, short B clips and animations and live bands and gore, but and puppet gore.
Yeah,
but our gore is like a...
Puppet gore.
Yeah.
We're really inspired by B, you know, so it's a, however we have to do it to do it, we just do it, you know. We want to get a scene across. We're not going to spend tons of money and try to get all kinds of people to help us do it. We're going to say, okay, we want blood, let's just make it, you know. We want this effect, let's just do it, you know. Just like, you know, just like any old B movie.
And we're very much into sci-fi and zombies and gore, so it's kind of like robot zombie love going on, you know?
Robot zombie love. Wait, can there be such a thing as a robot zombie?
Of course.
In the universe of Hell on Ice, there sure is.
Yes. Hell, the town of Hell is where a bunch of retired old carny folk live, and Ms. Monster, and there's drag racing and all sorts of insane stuff going on. So
I'm broaching the issue of the robot zombie, because if the robot is a mechanical, not living thing, or it could be a living thing, I mean, that's the question. What makes it a robot zombie?
When was the last time you heard of rational love, really, you know? Love that cannot be is really the best kind
love
of love.
Love that cannot be is B minus.
Love that cannot be is the love that can be minus.
To be or not to be minus?
Exactly.
Because once you go B, you never go back.
All right, well, thank you both.
Laughing and a clowning just to keep from crying. I'm laughing and a clowning just to keep from crying.
Okay, I could not actually leave here without actually stopping by the Laughing Squid booth. Hey, so who is this? Who am I talking with? Who are you?
It's Scott Beal. I'm the primary tentacle of Laughing Squid.
Okay, so what is your presence here? What do you hope to accomplish?
Nothing. No, I just come here. A lot of the people I host websites for are here. A lot of people I know. A lot of the artists that have done, you know, postcards and stuff for Alive and Squid are here. And you know, it's kind of being out there in the community, you know.
What do you have here that you're offering to the community here, besides, of course, love and warm hugs and fuzzies and all that?
We have some of our postcards that our artists have done and stickers and poster from our show last year and just giveaway stuff. It's mostly, yeah, you know, we don't sell anything. We're the cheap table.
But you also are celebrating 10 years here, too.
Yeah, we had our 10th anniversary last year of Laughing Squid, and so, yeah. So that's what the poster's from that Josh Ellingson did, which you can see online at laughingsquid.com.
And, you know, it's just 10 years, and you seem really, really enthusiastic about that.
Oh, just another decade, you know.
10 years, you know, it won't be really impressive until we hit that 25.
I don't know. I mean, it's kind of snuck up on us. I mean, it's like last year, I'm like, oh, crap, we better do something. It's 10 years, we can do something special. So, yeah, it's going fast.
Have your feelings for the squid changed in any way over the 10 years?
Well, the squid just evolved, you know. The tentacles are reaching out further and to more in different areas. And, you know, I don't know.
The tentacles more moist than they were 10 years ago?
Oh, that's pretty personal.
Well, no, I'm sure you have a very kind of way, a good... You're an expert on this sort of feeling.
Well, actually, I get so much squid stuff. Like, anytime there's any kind of squid news, people send me emails. So I just recently launched squid.us, which is a squid blog, all squid information all the time. So now I have a place for that because there's, yeah, I don't want to put all the squid stuff on Laughing Squid. Because Laughing Squid doesn't really have a whole lot to do with the actual squid animal for the most part. You know, so squid.us.
How did the name Laughing Squid come to be? I never knew.
Yeah, I need to come up with a good story for that. I mean, there isn't a one concise, you know, explanation, but it was more just kind of metaphoric of the tentacles that reach into all the different areas of things. And also, too, squids were sort of in the shadow of the octopus. You know, octopus is like, people know about octopus, but you don't usually hear squid stuff as much. Now you do, but back then, it seems like there's more squid stuff there is now than there was before for some reason.
I'm hoping to see the jellyfish revive, because I think jellyfish are beautiful, but because they sting people, they get a bad rap, I think.
Yeah, but it's hard to get, like, laughing Portuguese man-o-war, you know, it doesn't really work as well, but they're cool. Yeah, Attaboy does a lot of jellyfish, too. I mean, you know, my booth mate here.
Who's not here? You're all alone occupying yourself with an iBook. I said, you're all alone occupying your time with an iBook.
Yeah, it's because Attaboy's across the street getting something to drink. So, yeah, I do a booth with Attaboy and Annie Owens of Yum Factory, Ouch Club. They do a High Fructose magazine. And so it's all kind of very incestuous, and we've worked together for years. And
so, Ape, it's all about the incest.
Yeah, it is about incest. Independent incest. Independent underground incest. That's what Ape's all about.
Right. Well, thanks so much, Scott.
Thanks. Take care.
I looked across, and there I saw Billy waiting to go and join the line.
So I was wandering by a booth and I saw Bill's Bartending Guide, Pirates Take Manhattan, and then Man Enough, A Queer Romance. So who are you, sir, and what is all this all about? Please do tell us.
Greetings. I'm Bill Roundy of Bill's Bartending Guide and also of The Amazing Adventures of Bill. So I've been making mini comics for a couple of years, and my new one is Man Enough, A Queer Romance.
Now, what makes your bartending guide better than the other ones?
Well, because most bartending guides contain thousands of drinks, most of which taste terrible and call for liquors that no actual human keeps in their bar, like Anisette. So mine only has 50 drinks. All of them have four or less ingredients. They're all the normal liquors, and they're all easy to make. So there's no muddling mint leaves. There's no wacky stuff you have to do.
Can we assume that the Bill protagonist here in The Amazing Adventures of Bill is possibly one Bill who is I'm talking with right now?
That is correct.
Okay, well, what makes these adventures so amazing?
Well, my adventures are indeed amazing. It's a wacky life of drunkenness and debauchery in New York City. It's all true stories. I almost die in issue number 3, which is very exciting.
That's exciting for you personally, I hope, too.
Well, it was exciting in retrospect.
Terrifying, I would think, at the time.
At the moment, I was actually, there was this bit where I had to have my appendix removed. And I got a CAT scan, And the doctor came over to me afterwards and he says, we've got this strange hard object lodged in your rectum. Do you know what that is? And I said, have I shoved anything up my ass lately? No, I don't think I have. I have no idea. And he came away, and he went away, and he came back like 5 minutes later, and he said, we're so sorry. We had your x-ray turned the wrong direction. And I thought, this is going to make a great comic.
So do you live your life thinking, oh, you know what? That's going to be a great comic.
I do make a lot of notes, although they're mostly mental notes, so I tend to forget them by the time I actually get to the sketchbook.
Hence a journal.
Exactly.
Well, I'm also noting that you have purple fingernail polish. What's the deal with that?
Yes, I've been painting my nails for like 10 or 12 years now. I used to be goth, and I kind of gave up on the being depressed and wearing all black, but I really like painting my nails, so I kept it up.
Oh, okay, well, at least something...
Now I don't feel right if I don't have it.
How does the purple polish tie into your... I noticed there's a purple color here, and how does it tie into you as a cartoonist?
Well, of course, I'm wearing a purple shirt right now, so...
I wasn't going to mention that. I was drawing upon the more subtle attribute here.
It's all about the color coordination.
I mean, purple and actually cartooning. What's the correlation?
I don't believe that there is one, actually. The cover of Man Enough is blue and pink because... It's about sort of gender relations. It's about a romance between a gay man and a female-to-male transsexual. And some blue, some pink, oh, boys and girls, throwing them all together.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Bill. You're quite amazing.
You're welcome.
So I sat down here for a beer, and I was accosted by a gentleman who had
a costume. Never laid a hand on him. What a lie! And no, I was nowhere near them sheep.
Okay. Well, we've established that sheep were not involved, but flyers for a thing called Con Extreme was involved. And I was wondering, what makes Con Extreme? Why should we go to this? And you were also having a very ardent conversation about Spider-Man. Maybe you can identify yourself and tell us what your sort of existential plight is at the moment.
I'm Alex Diaz. I'm with BlackFleet.org, and we're also putting Con Extreme together. It's on a Yahoo group with con-x-treme, T-R-E-M-E.com. Go to Yahoo first. It's a charity convention benefiting kids with cancer, teens, and we're including anime, fantasy, sci-fi, Fantastic Realms, that's Renaissance, that's cosplay, that's manga, there's masquerades, we're including ballroom dancing, belly dancing. I'm running out of breath trying to tell you, and it's like we're still adding more, and we have until March of next year, 2007. We'd love to have you guys show up. We're going to be over at the Doubletree Hotel in San Jose. I'm running out of air, guy, and there's too much to remember. I'm getting old. Okay.
Okay, so, well, what makes this... you have the extreme angle? Is this, like, extreme everything, or what's the deal?
The extreme is we're including as many things and that as diverse as possible. Like I said, we're including the martial arts, swordplay, medieval, fantasy, sci-fi, belly dancing, ballroom dancing, and if you've got jitterbug dancing, we're going to include that also. Regency dancing, that's just the dancing part. Now, for things to keep you entertained, we got the gamers, and we're trying to get the video and the anime all night long. Also, we'll have TVs set up at different locations, running movies 24 hours.
Now, so all participants are supposed to dance at this thing? I mean, what's the deal? It seems very, very energy consuming. It's amazing, I have to say.
That is true. If you've been to a convention, there are times when you get a lull in the activities. Hey, go dance, even if you're just going to watch the ballroom dancing or the Regency dancing or even the Lindsay Hop dancing. It's something to keep you amused. We'll also have buffer wars. There's a lot of things we're trying to introduce and keep people's interest. Even if it's midnight, We want to keep you entertained. Besides, going to a convention where you stay at the hotel is exercise and staying up all night. So do you remember when going to the con was just a spiritual experience? Hey, when you go to a con and you're up for it, you're up 72 hours. Besides, you might miss something.
So basically, people can like dance at like 3 in the morning if they want to at Con Extreme.
Truly. Well, we're trying to keep things so they have something to keep them entertained. Besides, when you go to a convention, hey, you want something there to keep you going. And if you've been to a lot of conventions where you stay at the hotel, hey, that's what you want. You want to have that experience where you're going, wow, we went to the hotel. It was a cool experience. Hey, they got the swimming pool, the hot tub. Hey, what do you want to do? You want to schmooze over in the con suite area? That's all it is. Make contacts with the new friends, old friends, and maintain. Hey, fandom is a melting pot. It's not just anime. It's everything. And fandom crosses many lines, many genders, many things. And hey, I am a full-fledged card-carrying geek, and if you don't believe it, ask me. I'll show you my card.
Well, I don't think I've ever been to a comic convention with like flamenco dancing or anything like that.
Oh, well, flamenco dancing? Hey, if I can find the girl, I'll do it. There are many things going on. If you guys get a chance, go to my my website, blackfleet.org, and then go to Future Raids, calendar of events, which also included Rakasa and some parades and stuff with the Klingons, stuff with anime and stuff with movies. There's many things that can interest you to keep you going. Besides, if you're into fandom, you're being creative. You're making things. If you're just making computer games or you're just doing it on the website, live journal, you're doing something to keep creative, to keep you going. Otherwise, hey guys, it's a boring existence. Life is hard enough. Let's go have some fun.
So, okay, so is this the first convention you've actually ever organized?
This is my first. You got my cherry guy. What can I tell you? But I have the experience behind it. I've put Black Fleet over at cinemas where we've done promotionals for theater premieres, where we've been there for Star Wars, Pirates of the Caribbean, Men in Black. If you've ever gone to a theater and you see a whole bunch of people in costume, hey, it might have been my group. And we're out there to have fun. It's like if you go to a cinema, you're standing in line, you're bored to tears waiting for the movie to start. But if you're there in costume, hey, you're the center of distraction. What do you want?
Well, so are human beings, you know, you think that human beings are designed to have like 24/7 fun, if at all possible? Or?
If at all possible, whenever possible, and if you can stand it, go for it. I'm with the idea.
What about what about people who have vacations away from their vacation? This is going to probably exhaust a few people, maybe. I don't know.
Go to work and recover. That's what I do. I just go to work just to recover from all the exertion. For me, it's my mini vacation when I go to a 3-day con or a 4-day con. Yes, there are such things. Let's see, Comic-Con International is exciting and worth it. Worldcon is exciting and worth it. And if you've been to that, yes. If you haven't, oh my goodness, kid, you got to join the party. You're missing out.
All right. Well, what is blackfleets.com? What's that? It's a promotional sort of agency.
Black Fleet is part of BFSPG, which is Black Fleet Star Pirates Guild, which is a guild of costumers putting costumes together to go have fun. We are at conventions. We're at movie premieres. We're at events. We're at events like this. Sometimes we're in costumes, sometimes we're not. And other groups that we're associated with, we get invited to their parties. Isn't that nice? You get to go to parties in costume. And Halloween is my favorite time of year.
It's my favorite time of year. This reminds me very much of like the never-ending party that Douglas Adams once described in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you know, where the party had been going on for several years or something like that.
Oh, I like the idea. It's the never-ending story. Isn't it not? You just got to reread it. Start again next Saturday, or continue on, if you can do it. And if you can't, show me. I need the vitamins.
So fun is a narrative. Fun is the narrative component to life, then, you would say.
Isn't it? Why not? You need to have something to keep you interested. I've seen kids do the goth. They do it very well. I've seen kids do the anime costuming. They do it extraordinarily well. I've seen the Klingons, and they get involved in their costumes. The 501st Stormtroopers, they get involved in their costumes. And they're out there to have fun. Hey, what do you want to do with life? If you've got this talent, you might as well do something with it. And while you're at it, go have fun.
What do you say to a person who insists that life should not be about fun, that life should be about constant work and constant diligence, that fun is, you know, something that cannot be spared because there are other more important things?
More power to them. I'm not there to say you're doing it wrong. I'm only there to say, hey, if you need to do that and you want to live that, it's up to you. And there's nothing I can say to say anything bad against it. Some people really get involved in their careers. It's more power to them. But if you want to stop and have a fresh smell of the flowers along the way and say, hey, I had a good time, thank you. But, you know, it's up to you. It's always up to the individual. And you shouldn't be saying, just because that person does costuming, that person does computers, that person does illustration, publications, law, medicine, whatever. If they're into it, they're involved, they have something to keep them going.
So you're more of a facilitator than just, you know, you just want to at least allow people to have this sort of experience of fun. And you know, if they want to have it, great. If not, you're not out there to, like, sort of, like, you know, have a fun ideology that you'd like to spread.
The ideology is an individual thing. It's how much that person wants or where they would like to do. You don't have to go. If you just want to get your toe wet, that's fine. If you want to immerse yourself, fine. The ideology is just each individual. For as much as they want, for as long as they want. The worst thing is to say you're doing it wrong. And if it's a first-time costumer, I turn around and say, hey, cool, what'd you do? Show me how you did it. I've met some people who did their X-Wing uniforms and looked grungy. And they met some costumers who had the pristine outfits. And when I ran into them, they said, hey, they said we look grungy. And I turned it around and said, hey, you're frontline troops due for rotation. You're the veterans. What do you think now?
I was about to say that, too. Well, thanks so much. Yeah.
Thank you. Nice meeting you. Hope to meet you at my convention. I'm Alex. I'm also known as Obi-Hay, Obi-Wan, Obi-Cuz, Obi-Quiet, El Obi-Ben-Wan, the Egyptian flesh peddler. See me? Come up and say hi. We'd like to meet you.
All right, Obi, man of all Obis here. Okay, so I'm here with Daniel Kloes here at APE. Dan, how's it going?
It's going well. My name is pronounced Klaus, actually.
Klaus, I'm so sorry.
I've heard many, many permutations, but that was an odd one, I have to say.
Oh, you're like the 60 billionth person I've talked with, so if it's any consolation.
I'm sure. I can only imagine.
Okay, so you've got Art School Confidential, you've got the film coming out. What's coming up with 8-Ball and what's coming up with all the other stuff?
You know, right now I have nothing to promote except this film, and I had a book called Ice Haven that came out from Pantheon last year, but... right now I'm sort of in the beginning stages on all my projects, both in comics and film, and so there won't be anything for a while. Might be something by the end of this year and mid-next year, but nothing I can even talk about yet.
Okay. Well, have you found it sort of easy to jump between the film and the comic book sort of mediums?
You know, they each have their own challenges, and I'm much more comfortable with the comics. You know, that's much more... my field, but you know, the movies are fun. It's good to get away from the drawing board occasionally. It can be quite draining to sit and stare at a blank piece of paper every day for 13 years.
Sure. Well, do you feel that you can sort of, is it a question of trust? Do you feel that you could trust Terry Zwigoff?
I do. Well, Terry and I understand each other, and I sort of know his sense of humor, and I know the kinds of things that he's interested in, and so I can trust him to sort of do his thing and with, you know, but it would be interesting to work with other people too. I'd certainly like to work with other directors down the line and see, you know, the kinds of things somebody else would bring to it.
But do you fear that perhaps working with somebody else, you wouldn't have nearly the kind of creative control you have with Terry?
Yeah, you know, no screenwriter really has a lot of creative control. You know, I have as much as anybody ever would working with Terry, but in the end, he still makes all the final decisions, and there's all these tiny little things that are never exactly the way I want it to go, you know, and so it's always, it's never my final work. So I don't know that working with somebody who'd changed it completely would be all that much more or less frustrating.
Now, Art School Confidential started off as a story in 8-Ball. Did you find that expanding it into a feature film was problematic, or is there additional layers to this script that we haven't sort of seen, or how did that work out?
I mean, the story, it's only a 4-page story, so it's really almost nothing. It's more like a Mad Magazine article, and so I felt very free to not worry about, you know, being beholden to my own work. I felt like I could just do anything I wanted as long as I used that title. So that was really all we took, was the title and the very idea that we're setting something in an art school.
So this is like completely different because it's not a matter of transposing a previous story onto a screenplay template. Did you feel that it was tougher to kind of create like that into a 120-page screenplay? Or?
It was actually somewhat easier, just because with Ghost World I had to sort of adapt the story as it appeared in the comic and then realize that that was not the way to go and abandon it and start over. Whereas with this story, I knew from the beginning it was going to have to be its own thing, and so it was all a matter of sort of evolving from that beginning rather than, you know, having to scrap a year of work as I did with Ghost World.
Okay. Do you feel that these film adaptations get in the way of actually producing more comics, or do you feel that you're kind of working on two creative conduits right now?
You know, I feel like it's, I don't know in terms of time, I'm sure it takes up my time from doing comics, but in terms of inspiration, I feel I'm so much more excited to work on comics when I have something else to go back and forth with. And just working on comics all the time for years and years and years gets very tiring, and it's great to have a way to sort of get a new perspective on it, which is what this is really.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Dan.
You tangle every weekend. They might start different, but it ends up the same. One minute he catches you and he's speaking, the next you don't go.